a letter to the federal judge overseeing the case of Epstein's former partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was sentenced for trafficking minors, urging the judge to appoint a special master to force the Department of Justice to release all the Epstein files. They note the DOJ has released 12,000 of the more than 2 million documents subject to the act, and later wrote there could be upwards of 5 million documents. A Newsweek report this week, citing filings from the Department of Justice, wrote at the slow pace of release, Trump's DOJ won't complete the release until after he leaves office. Trump is cited in the Epstein files. The House passed an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies to help some 22 million Americans afford health care coverage Thursday. It heads to the Senate next. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the post.
Greetings y bienvenidos to part 3 of the best of the Latino Media Collective in 2025 here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we take a look back on the year that was in 2025 for both the Latino community here in the U.S. and the biggest moments in Latin America and the Caribbean. Part 3 will focus on the continued threat of military criminal violence by the U.S. towards Venezuela. As people have heard, the U.S. bombed the Venezuelan capital of Caracas and kidnapped President Nicolas Maduro to the shock of Latin America and the entire world. This U.S. hostility towards Venezuela did not happen overnight and is not exclusive to the Trump administration nor the Republican Party. Both parties have been supportive of the imperialist actions towards Venezuela that set these tragic chain of events in motion. For example, we spoke with Venezuelan sociologist Maria Paez Victor back in the spring about the demonization of migrants that also play a part in what we saw this month. I have to say that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, we can't have this conversation without mentioning Nayib Bukele, the current authoritarian president of El Salvador, and the absurd position that he has taken in this whole criminal scheme of demonizing Venezuelan migrants. And this past April, it was reported that he had gone so far to propose like a prisoner exchange. That's the polite way to say it. A prisoner exchange, which is more like extortion of Venezuelan migrants in the Sicaut prison, you know, obviously for money, but also in exchange for political prisoners in Venezuela. You'll forgive me. I'm a little embarrassed to ask you this, but last time I checked, Venezuela is not at war with El Salvador. And so this proposal, at first glance, is pretty absurd for the president of El Salvador to ask for political prisoners, Venezuelan political prisoners, quote unquote, to be released in exchange for Venezuelan migrants who have, up to this point, have no criminal records and no due process as well. And at first glance, I say because Nayib Bukele does have a public relations background and he has had relations with right-wing Venezuelans who have helped him with regards to his media relations. So there is something under the surface, but that doesn't take away the absurdity of him acting as a deputy here for the Trump administration. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Bukele in this whole criminal scheme here.
He's an embarrassment to Latin America, not just to El Salvador, but he has truly besmirched the heroic, I would say, tradition and history of Latin America, especially Central America, and all of the many people who have given their lives for the dignity and the independence of El Salvador, of Guatemala, of Mexico, of the entire Caribbean and Latin America. I think that he is a man who really, I hate to say this, but he really doesn't have roots in El Salvador. He really doesn't understand his own country and his own history, because if he did, he'd never act like this. So I think he's a very ignorant man, and he is very dangerous, of course, and he has found wonderful partners in the fascist, I say leaders of the opposition of Venezuela, but they're leaders of nothing. These international criminals, which is what I call Maria Corina Machado and Leopoldo Lopez and Juan Guaido, they have robbed Venezuela of absolute billions. And by the way, they've also robbed the United States, because they received a substantial amount of millions from USAID and pocketed them. USAID is no more, but before it was no more, it acknowledged that the money that they had given to Juan Guaido, they don't know what happened to it. It was ill spent in terrible things, which I am embarrassed to talk about. But what I want to say is that I think that Bukele's political life is not going to be very long, nor his legacy. I don't think that the people of El Salvador, who have truly suffered immensely during those terrible years, are going to accept this. And I have every hope that his terms will be short and his legacy will be nil in the dustbins of history. I want to say that there are no political prisoners in Venezuela. Everyone who's in a prisoner in Venezuela has gone through a trial and has had the benefit of lawyers. You know, I have to tell you this, ever since we had a new constitution, that was the grand thing that Hugo Chavez did. When he was elected in the year 1999, he put his hand on the old constitution and he said, I swear on this moribund constitution, this dying constitution, that I will carry on my duties and whatnot. Because his campaign was that we were going to have a new constitution, because the old constitution was created by the elites and it had all kinds of terrible things in it. So Venezuela had one of the most progressive, it still has, one of the most progressive constitutions in the region for certain. And it was written in ordinary Spanish. It wasn't legalese. You know, sometimes lawyers write in a way that you really don't understand what they're talking about. This was, if you know Spanish, you can read the constitution and you can understand it. Well, the Venezuelan people became real experts on the Constitution. Everybody has a Constitution in a little booklet this big, everybody in their pockets, in their handbags. And so Venezuelans are very legalistic. They will tell you Article so-and-so and Article so-and-so, and they become real legal experts on their own Constitution, which is really hilarious because, you know, in these countries that we live in, you know, you say, oh, the Constitution, people, roll their eyes and say, you know, I haven't read that. But the question of political prisoners in Venezuela is not existent. If there are prisoners, it's because they committed some crime that they went to the judge. There was a trial and they were convicted. So that is not political prisoners. But I also want to say something. Venezuela has never gone to war. The only time that Venezuelan troops have left Venezuela to go to another country was as the Army of Liberation. And it went under Simón Bolívar, and it liberated from the Spanish Empire, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and of course, Panama didn't exist because it was part of Colombia. So the only time that the Venezuelan army has ever left the country was not against a war against a neighbor. It was against an empire, and it was the Army of Liberation. We have never gone to war, and it's a great sort of pride that we are not an aggressive country that wants to go to war against it. Even now, with what ExxonMobil is trying to do in Guyana, you know, Venezuelans are saying, look, this isn't Guyana doing this. This is ExxonMobil that ExxonMobil has put Guyana in his pocket.
Once again, everything that we've discussed here is a far cry from the corporate media narrative that would give people the impression here in the U.S. that Venezuela is about to take over all of Latin America and take over all of the Western Hemisphere. All this fear and paranoia and exaggeration that is nowhere close to the reality that we discussed during the course of this conversation. What is reality, though, is the demonization of Venezuelan migrants. Even as we have this conversation this week, the Trump administration has stripped the protected status of close to 350,000 migrants, most of them Venezuelans, which unfortunately gives me the impression that this demonization is only going to get worse before it gets any better. And so one of the things I'm going to do with this conversation is create a Twitter link to your article in Counterpunch so people can learn more, not only about the demonization of Venezuelan migrants, but also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which you also put in your article as well. And so usually I ask guests, what else do you hope people learn from your recent article? But again, at the same time, it seems like things are only going to get worse before they get any better here in the U.S. with regards to this dehumanization of Venezuelan migrants. And before you answer it, I just want to say this as well, that the Biden administration is equally culpable with this narrative of demonizing Venezuelan migrants, because it didn't start with Trump alone. There are a lot of years and a lot of time before this second Trump administration that set this demonization of Venezuelan migrants in motion.
Yes, you're quite right. It was Obama. It was Obama who said that Venezuela posed a threat to U.S. security. And everybody laughed. Everyone said, what? The Venezuelans are going to go and march on Washington? What is this ridiculous? Everybody thought, what, he's gone crazy. No, the reason he said that was because if there is a threat to the security, then the president of the United States can take all sorts of measures without going to Congress. And this is what, of course, especially what Mr. Trump has done, that he can do all these things because he doesn't have to go through Congress, because he said, oh, they're invading us. The Venezuelans are invading us. Remember when he said that the migrants were eating pets in somewhere? I mean, they're inventing all of this so that then the president can take all of these measures without going through Congress. This is very dangerous, again, for the United States, because your representatives are in Congress. They represent the people. And if the people are being pushed aside by a president, whichever president, who says, oh, no, look, you know, I'm going to decree this and I'm going to decree that. You have a president who's governing by decree. And so what is happening to the people that you voted for, your representatives in Congress? This is, again, a very dangerous thing for you. But I want to say something to you, that I want to emphasize this. In Venezuela, we don't have a mass of people, because the people are all organized. We have what is called communal councils and communes. And that is that any group of people in any local area can become a communal council. And that communal council then is the one to decide the kind of things that that community needs. Like, for example, it needs roads, or it needs water pipes, or it needs a school. And so the communal councils and the communes are the ones that have been very central to the survival of Venezuela. The rural communes are the ones who have fed Venezuela. Because from being a country, you know, plans it and tells people you do this, you do the other. No, these are this grassroots, I would say, network of, we have almost 50,000 communal councils and about 5,000 communes, which are the representatives of the communal councils. And so that has been something that is so beautiful. If any of you go to Venezuela, go visit a communal council, because this is the people in motion. I was talking with the mayor, because the municipality is still there. And so I said to the mayor, well, how does that work, that you're the mayor and you have municipal councils, but at the same time you have the communal councils out there? How do you make decisions? And he said, well, you know, we in the municipality may say, you know, we really need to pave some of the streets because they need to be paved. And the representatives say that. But it's the communal councils who will say what streets are going to be paved. So you see, they at the beginning, they didn't know how to work. But now, after all these years, they really work together very, very well. It is a form of, if you like, of public participation. And nobody is, you know, you don't have to belong to the government party or the opposition party or anything like that. This is truly public participation. Why? Because the Venezuelan democracy is called a participatory democracy. And I want to say one last thing. They used to say that, oh, Cuba is a dictatorship because there are no elections. Actually, there were elections, but this is what they said. There are no elections. And then Venezuela, who has elections practically every year, oh no, those elections, you know, they don't work. You know, those are not true. Since 1999, we've had 32 elections. The next elections is the end of this month. Elections for governors, elections for deputy of the assembly. We have elections for president. The elections have all kinds of parties. I think there's about 35 political parties that are joining in this. There's about 6,000 candidates. And how is that not democracy? How is that not democracy when we have international people, international witnesses going to Venezuela and saying, yes, it was a good election. There was no shenanigans. There was no problem. It all went, actually, it went even better than your elections because in 24 hours we knew who had won. But, you know, it doesn't matter. They will say whatever they want about Venezuela. And Venezuela just says, we're carrying on. We have our government and we have come out of the tunnel now.
Maria Paez Victor was a frequent guest in 2025 as U.S. military threats towards Venezuela went from dangerous to the absurd. No case was more absurd than the Nobel Peace Prize Committee awarding the Peace Prize to right-wing political operative Maria Corina Machado. So Maria, along with Canadian freelance writer Joe Emmersberger, minced no words in their assessment of Machado back in October. We had a conversation about how Venezuela's corporate media played a role in the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez. And perhaps we made the mistake of mentioning right-wing politician Marina Corina Machado into existence because she shockingly won the Nobel Peace Prize this month. This despite the fact that, as we discussed in our last episode, she was a signatory of the notorious Carmona Decree during the coup, which essentially suspended Venezuelan democracy in 2002. She has also been a supporter of various other right-wing protests over the years that have resulted in violence. And so here's a clip, actually, of the Nobel Prize announcement. So let's take a listen.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 goes to a brave and committed champion of peace, to a woman who keeps the flame of democracy burning amidst a growing darkness. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado. She is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy. Maria Corina Machado meets all the three criteria stated in Alfred Nobel's will for the selection of a peace prize. She has brought her country's opposition together. She has never wavered in resisting the militarization of Venezuelan society. She has been steadfast in her support for a peaceful transition to democracy.
I'm sorry. I'm sick here. I'm going to be sick.
Well, there you have it. That was the Nobel Prize announcement of Maria Corina Machado. So let me just start right there, Maria. Even while I was playing that clip, I could see the look in your face of indignation. So go ahead, just give me your initial thoughts on what you just heard here in this announcement.
Well, first of all, I want to throw all the scorn that I have on this committee. I know this is a far-fetched thing, but bear with me. When the Catholic Church, I'm a Catholic, when the Catholic Church is going to declare somebody a saint, whether you believe this or not, they start investigating this person and they start looking at the miracles and the wonderful things that they did. But they also select a very high-rated priest or bishop to be what is called the devil's advocate. And this priest has to go around looking for all the bad things that person did, has to go around and investigate whether this person was good or bad or, you know, all the bad things so that they could have some sort of idea. So I wonder, what kind of research did this peace committee do that it did not pick up any newspaper from any of the countries of Latin America who would have recorded what this woman, this is a woman of war. This is a woman of violence. This is a woman who wouldn't know democracy if it slapped her in the face. She has opposed the voting in Venezuela. She has tried to destroy each and one of the elections in Venezuela. I know I shouldn't be personal, but she's an awful person. She has not brought together the opposition. She has destroyed the opposition in Venezuela. They hate her. You know, this prize that they give her, usually in countries when a prize is given, oh, they have a, you know, parties or they have demonstrations. Or the opposition in Venezuela has said nothing about this woman and her prize because they are so disgusted. She would be given, by the way, she's been given money by the CIA forever. She is a stooge of the CIA. And many a time she would get all this money from them. And guess what? She wouldn't share it with the other opposition parties. So they're very, very upset at her. But they're mostly they're upset because she has repeatedly asked for the invasion of Venezuela. She has supported these war ships outside Venezuelan waters. And she is despised by all. You know, unfortunately for them, their ploy has failed because they expected that in Venezuela, oh, they give her the prize, the opposition is going to then come out in the streets and they're going to rally around her. Nothing. I have been speaking to Venezuela constantly all these days. She says, it's like she didn't exist. Nobody gives a damn that she'd been given this prize. It's a joke. Nobody talks about it. So their narrative has not been asked. Everything that committee said there is a lie and a verifiable. It is verifiable for anyone with just a tiny bit of research to find out what this woman's public statements have been apart from her actions. She has blood on her hands. Hundreds and hundreds of Venezuelans have died because she backed the sanctions, because she has backed every mercenary attack. She has backed every cyber attack for Venezuela. You know what she backed? She backed that Pfizer and Moderna were not able to sell vaccines to Venezuela. This woman is truly quite devilish and has all of that money that was stolen from Venezuela's assets in foreign banks. And she thinks this is wonderful. And of course, she backs Israel. She backs the genocide in Gaza. She wrote a letter, for goodness sake, a letter written to Netanyahu asking him, oh, bring your Mossad, bring your army to Venezuela and liberate us. Imagine that. This is the kind of woman. Never has she said, you know, there should be peace in Venezuela. We should work together with the government. We should find some way, you know, which this country should be. Never, never has she said this. She has always been, Maduro has to go. The government has to go down. The United States has to come in and save us. So all I can tell you is that this woman who promoted the migration of Venezuelans out of the country, she promoted this along with the others. Leave Venezuela. Venezuela is a terrible country. She got the United States to give them a permit so they could go there. And then what she does? She goes to the president of the United States and say, these people are terrorists. They are part of the Tren de Aragua, which was a local little bunch of thugs, huh? And they are terrorists. And so she backed all the abuse that these migrants have obtained. She backed the gulag in El Salvador. She thought Bukele was a great guy. And right now, well, she is backing this now putative invasion of Venezuela. She's an awful person. Nothing to do with peace.
This is why you really become one of my favorite guests here on the show, because you don't mince any words at all whatsoever. Joe, you were shaking your head in disbelief and listening to that announcement. I want to get your thoughts as well.
It's almost comical to me. It's so preposterous that she could get an award. She's a despicable person. She's a supporter, like Maria said, she's a supporter of the Holocaust in Gaza. Her party, Vente Venezuela, actually has a formal agreement with Netanyahu's party. They have an inter-party agreement. It's published up. You can find all this stuff on her Twitter account. I mean, this is all easily searched if they did any research at all. And I don't think they did. I think they just take the word of the Western establishment. They know she's liked by the Western establishment, by big NGOs like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who are really evil organizations. People really need to stop taking them seriously. I'll point out one thing. Ken Roth, he ran Human Rights Watch for decades, and he's a big promoter of Machado. And on his Twitter account, he was obviously happy, expressed his appreciation that she won the award. But then he had to, because he has been critical, he's been trying to kind of cover himself, I would say cover his rear end, by opposing Trump's homicides in the Caribbean recently, you know, blowing up these boats, saying that they're Venezuelan drug traffic. And even Ken Roth has had to say, okay, now we shouldn't just execute people at sea. He's actually said that, right? Because, I mean, it's so obvious that he can't even pretend to be a credible human rights person if he supports these extrajudicial executions or just homicides that Trump's perpetrating openly, gleefully. And so when he expressed his appreciation for Machado getting the award, he said, oh, but it's a bad that she condones these murders. So he admits, on one hand, he's happy that she got the award, but the other, that she actually, Machado is such a horrible human being that she actually condones these executions that Trump's perpetrating in the Caribbean. I mean, it's just absolutely astounding. And it's really on so many levels, there's so many things you could point to. Maria's mentioned many of them that by themselves should disqualify this person from any kind of award. And I'll just mention that the Nobel Prize, let's not forget, they gave it to Kissinger. Yeah. Okay, that alone should have discredited it forever. He's one of the biggest mass murderers of the post-World War II era, easily. They gave it to Obama, another mass murderer. And even some of the lesser known figures, like if you look at this person they gave it to in 2021, this person, Maria Reza, they gave it to her. She's a Filipino journalist of something. And she made a statement where they asked her about Assange. She's the person who should have gotten the Nobel Prize, who'd been a good candidate for it at that time. He was nominated. They didn't go to Assange. He exposed Western war crimes, and she denounced him. She said he wasn't doing real journalism. This was fresh after winning her Nobel Prize. She just joins the establishment in slandering a real dissident, a real human rights hero, I would say. So yeah, it's a ridiculous award. They've proved it multiple times that they're not to be taken seriously. Anyone who is genuinely deserving probably refuse it, but yeah, and obviously they could have given the award to any of the kidnapped doctors in Israel right now who've been kidnapped from Gaza and are still being held. They could have given it to them. The Nobel could have actually done some good, put pressure on Israel to give back these doctors. And they didn't do that. Instead, they give it to this fascist. It's totally disgusting.
We end part three of the best of 2025 by going to a recent interview with freelance writer and frequent guests Arturo Dominguez and Egberto Willis from Pacifica Station KPFD in Houston this past December, just on the cusp of the U.S. bombing of Caracas. So let's begin by putting aside the legal jargon and ambiguity of the U.S. drone strikes on boats off the coast of Venezuela with the following. This escalation of military tension towards Venezuela has nothing to do with drugs and everything to do with oil. Oil has been the main motive behind U.S. hostilities towards Venezuela for the last 27 years. Oil is the same motive that led to the same playbook that led the U.S. to invade Iraq in 2003. Oil is the main motive for these sort of military actions and crimes, no matter which political party is in power. So it's oil all day and all night, 24/7. And you don't have to take my word for it. Here is a clip from Representative Maria Elvira Salazar telling Fox Business last month, basically the quiet parts out loud. So let's take a listen.
Oh, I think Maduro is not Fidel Castro. Maduro is not a brave boy. So now that he has understood that he is on that very nefarious list of the terrorist organization, that the airspace above Venezuela has been closed off and the commercial airlines from the United States are not flying, he's understanding that we're about to go in. He understands that he is he has been our enemy for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. Venezuela, for those Americans who do not understand why we need to go in, for three reasons. You're in Fox Business. Venezuela, for the American oil companies, will be a field day because it will be more than $1 trillion in economic activity. American companies can go in and fix all the oil pipe, the whole oil rigs, and everything that has to do with the Venezuelan petroleum companies, or anything that has to do with oil and the derivatives. Number two, Venezuela has been the launching pad, the hub for our enemies, the Iranian, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Cubans, the Nicaraguans, people that hate the United States. And the only thing they want to do is do harm to us and to our young Americans. And number three, he is the head of the Sons Cartel, which is one of the transnational criminal organizations. In 2020, Nicolas Maduro was indicted by a federal grand jury for drug trafficking, and he is the head of the Sons Cartel. So right there, the economy, security, and politically speaking, we're going to be doing a favor to us, to our children, to our economy, to our oil companies, to be able to liberate, and to the Venezuelans, that they do want to be free.
So that was Florida Representative Maria Elvira Salazar, sort of, again, saying the quiet parts out loud, which is that this is about oil, incoherence in between that, and ends the response with more about oil. So Arturo Dominguez, I mentioned at the beginning here the same playbook that led to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Are we repeating that same playbook? Because, I mean, there was a little bit more sophistication back in the day that led to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But listening to things like that, it's like sophistication is all gone. Not even an ambiguity. It's all out there in the open that this is all about oil, be all and end all.
I had to notice that, and I'm sure y'all did too, that the Venezuelans were the very last thing she mentioned. And she mentioned that with barely a breath left, right? So obviously Venezuelans are not the priority here. But no, this is the same thing as Iraq. You know, it's false narratives. It's, you know, putting people on TV to repeat the false narratives over and over again. And, you know, with stuff like the Monroe Doctrine, which essentially gives us dominion, well, perceived dominion over Latin America, you know, the United States, all they have to do is create false narratives, convince the public, and it's war. We've talked with Egberto extensively about Panama, right? Same thing. Create false narratives, you know, get the public support, war. And if you kill several thousand people, you know, that doesn't matter to any of these folks. You know, the clip was honestly, I believe, was a little bit of a psychological warfare. Because once she said, we're going in any minute, within about an hour, there were three bombers that left the Midwest here in the U.S. and went straight toward Venezuela. And then they traveled back and forth on the coast between, you know, of Venezuela, Colombia, Guyana, and stuff like that for several hours. And then they just left. And I think that this was part of a little bit of psychological warfare. A lot of what we're seeing right now is psychological warfare. And I often wonder if they thought if they put 25% of the U.S. Navy in the Caribbean, if Nicolas Maduro was going to run, if he was going to hide, if he was going to step down. And I hate to say it, but, you know, he has more support in the country than people believe. And at the moment, Donald Trump has done nothing but unite Venezuela around him to defend the country from imperialism, because no matter how much Venezuelans hate their government or country or whatever, or the leader, they celebrate their independence as much as we do, if not more so. They just celebrated their, 218th Independence Day from Spain, the Bolivarian Revolution. People don't understand that that means a lot in Venezuela. And the U.S. represents going back to what life was like before the Bolivarian Revolution. Overall, Venezuelans in the country are not very supportive of what the United States is trying to do. And that's my assessment from, you know, the extensive reporting, talking to Venezuelans, you know, across social media in the country, You know, I have readers that are in Venezuela, and they all, this is what they're telling me, you know. And you look at how many people have joined the military in Venezuela, and just since all this started, and it's pretty obvious that Venezuelans are not supportive of what the U.S. is trying to do right now.
Egberto Willis, based on what we heard, I want to get your response as well as the issue of whether or not we're repeating the same playbook that we saw in Iraq back in 2003.
Yeah, I agree with Arturo. It's the same playbook, but let me tell you what's disconcerting to me. You would think Americans are getting more sophisticated, so each time you would think that the message would be more sophisticated. The fact that she wants you to believe that Venezuela has anything to do with Iran, Hezbollah, and all these other terrorists. Why would any American believe that these guys would be over here in Venezuela doing anything? I mean, the logistics simply makes no sense. And I think that we have to understand this. The gall of a country to think that they are the ones who will control your airspace. When they come and they say, we're shutting down your airspace, that the gall that they have to decide what kind of government should be in Venezuela. Being from Panama and watching the same thing for decades from my inception, it's hard to see the same thing occur over and over again. And in Venezuela, what we're looking at specifically is that they cannot accept that a socialist country would be sitting on top of the largest bank of oil, the largest pool of oil in the world. And the problem is that if that regime was ever made successful, starting from Chavez, they could not make that regime successful because Americans themselves would start asking, wait a minute, all that oil in Colorado, all that oil in New Mexico, all that oil in Texas shouldn't belong to a few. We should look at a country who says the natural resources belong to us all. We cannot have that. And a lot of people don't see the ideological fight that's really going on here. It's very ideological. We cannot have a country with that much riches be controlled by anything but capitalism.
And thank you for mentioning Hugo Chavez, because we should clarify that Nicolas Maduro has been president since 2013, not 25 mm-hmm. years like Ms.
Well,
Salazar
it's a regime.
Said. Exactly. Yeah. And so if the parallels between Venezuela today and Iraq in 2003 wasn't bad enough, here is Representative Maria Elvira Salazar again distorting history of the U.S. invasion of another Latin American country. So let's take a listen.
I don't think they're going to, because last year, the Venezuelans under Maria Corina Machado and the opposition forces, they held elections, presidential elections. And those elections reflected and they showed that 80% of the Venezuelans, including the military, voted against the Maduro regime. So we know, we have information that maybe the top echelon of the military forces in Venezuela may be with Maduro, and they're going to flee with him. But the middle and lower ranks are with the opposition. We're talking about that this is going to be very similar to Panama. That I was there. I was a news reporter. And I remember when the Marines were
too.
Walking
yeah.
in and the Panamanians girls were asking them to marry them.
Yeah.
I think it's very similar.
Yes, exactly. So, okay. So obviously there's a distortion of history there from a supposedly former news reporter in Maria Elvira Salazar, which is a sad indictment of Spanish-speaking news media in this country. And if any other representative were to say that, it's insane. But it's even worse when you consider that she's the chair of one of the subcommittees on Western Hemispheric Affairs. Now, we don't have to go through the whole history of the U.S. invasion of Panama. In fact, we did a fantastic show last year with Egberto, along with friend of the show Michael Fox, on the U.S. invasion of Panama. But Egberto, I'm curious to get your thoughts on what she just said here.
She doesn't know what she's talking about. First of all, the Americans were never welcomed into Panama for the invasion. Secondly, the only information they have out of Panama as far as they're concerned is what the military told them, which was nothing but a conglomerate of lies. I mean, these guys, because our guy, Pina, cara de Pina, because you see, that's how we know him, cara de Pina.
Yeah.
Because cara de Pina did not do what Bush wanted him to do, they came in to take out one guy. And for that one guy, we killed thousands of Panamanians. I don't see how you use that as an example when the rest of the world saw that for exactly what it was, the systemic murder of Panamanians to get one guy and to really overthrow the government. It is shameful that she would bring that up. And I tell you what, Venezuela will be no different than Panama. The only difference I see is that while the Panamanians didn't have a force to really fight them, Venezuela does.
Arturo, I want to get your thoughts on this because people can't see us because we're on the radio, but I'm curious to get your opinion on this distortion of history.
Yeah, I mean, Egberto nailed it. Like, you know, he knows the history better than we do. He was there. But I've heard this, people bring up, name one country where, you know, U.S. interventionism was successful, and a lot of people mention Panama. And I'm like, that just goes to show how little people really know about what happened in Panama. You know, and to touch on what Egberto said at the end, this whole idea that they think they're just going to walk into Venezuela and take it. Like, she's trying to convince people that 80% of Venezuelans support, you know, Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez. And you guys already know that I have issues with that data the opposition provided.
Wrote a lot about that.
Right. And that's because there's a lot of fraudulent looking stuff in there. And it leaves me to believe, I can't say Maduro won the election, but I can't say he lost it either. I can't say they won because their data is really corrupted. A lot of, you know, forged signatures, none of the tally sheets have been certified, so they can't be validated. There's a lot of issues with that stuff. So at this point, I still don't know who won that election, but it's kind of irrelevant because had they really won that election, they wouldn't have had to provide busted looking data. 80%, there's no way. Ask any Venezuelan and they'll tell you that the only people who support, and they use only a lot, the only people who support Maduro are like the black Venezuelans, indigenous Venezuelans, and the poor, right? But those same people will tell you 80 to 90% of Venezuela is poor. I'm not going to say 80 to 90% of Venezuela supports Maduro, but the latest poll, which came from the Venezuelan legislature, so take this with whatever grain of salt you want, they're saying that Maduro right now has 73% approval rating over how he is dealing with the United States.
Compare that to Trump.
And right. Again, and that seems more believable to me, but I will put the actual number, just an educated guess, somewhere in between 20 to, you know, under 50%, but probably close to 50% approval rating for Maduro right now. There are a lot of armed militias in the jungles and in the mountains in Venezuela. A lot of them are pro-Maduro. A lot of them are opposition-type forces. In the last election, there was 10 candidates. More than half of them were opposition to Maduro. 9 of the 10 candidates validated Maduro's results in the election. The only ones that didn't were Machado and Gonzalez. Gonzalez, you know, backed away from the data that was provided. I wasn't the one who uploaded it. So there's a lot of suspicion there. This idea, again, that 80% of the population supports a woman that's just so broadly hated because she's far right. And she wants to, the last coup that she was involved in, when they tried to coup Chavez in 2002, they immediately threw out the Constitution, and the Constitution has protections, yes, for indigenous people and black people in there.
Yes, we did an entire show on the absurdity of Maria Corina Machado getting the Nobel Prize,
right,
a few weeks ago. And I didn't want to make this the Maria Elvira Salazar show here with all these clips, but she did mention Machado in those outrageous statements about a 100-day plan, quote unquote, following regime change. And so that tells you more with regards to how much she's hated in Venezuela and how right-wing and how aligned she is with this current Trump administration. And this leads us now to, I guess at this point, the footage that we've all seen by now of U.S. airstrikes on Venezuelan boats. The Trump administration claims to be drug boats despite presenting no evidence. Here's Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last week at the Ronald Reagan Defense Forum, of all places, defending these strikes on these boats. Let's take a listen.
Right now, the world is seeing the strength of American resolve in stemming the flow of lethal drugs to our country. These narco-terrorists are the Al-Qaeda of our hemisphere, and we are hunting them with the same sophistication and precision that we hunted Al-Qaeda. We are tracking them, we are killing them, and we will keep killing them so long as they are poisoning our people with narcotics so lethal that they're tantamount to chemical weapons.
So again, that was Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth justifying actions off the coast of Venezuela. So Arturo, we started this conversation saying if the playbook of Iraq in 2003 is being repeated, certainly the rhetoric is being repeated. And you have an article in your Substack page discussing the criminality of what's taking place off the coast of Venezuela. I wonder if you could tell us more as it pertains to your article.
Well, you know, obviously striking boats like that, unarmed boats, is a war crime. The double tap thing that the media keeps talking about, they're saying that the double tap thing is a war crime. The reality is they're all war crimes, right? You're killing people without due process. They're not armed. They're not an immediate threat to any military vehicle, boats, anything. You know, those boats are not big enough to make it to the United States. You know, they're island hopping. They leave the coast of South America. They hit a Caribbean island somewhere, and God only knows what happens from there. But there's no way that boat is making an 1,800-mile trip across the Gulf. If you've ever been deep sea fishing, you would know that. That is not that kind of boat. You know, the submarines they seize and all this stuff, same thing. Those things cannot make that trip. These are like made in somebody's garage type boats, you know, like the submarines and stuff. They're not, you know, engineered or anything like that. Yeah, and you hear them bragging about the Coast Guard interdicting boats and seizing the drugs and bringing the guys into custody and throwing them in a federal prison. And they still do that. And that's the legal process for this. You know, distributing drugs is not a war crime. It's not a crime punishable by death. The implications that they're suggesting that these guys are the equivalent to Al-Qaeda, come on. Are they suicide bombing anything? I mean, are they threatening to blow up your house? They're not anywhere close to the United States. Like, it's ridiculous, you know, and it just speaks to the outright incompetence of this administration. It makes them so dangerous. You know, Hegseth was kicked out of the military. He's nowhere near qualified to have the job that he has. And it's clear to me by now, and I've been trying to find this out ever since he said in February when he was at Stuttgart, Germany at AFRICOM, he said he was seeking unilateral authority to conduct drone strikes. Something that's never been done before because that's solely a power reserved for the president. Obama got grief about potentially letting generals do drone strikes without his approval. Trump and his first administration didn't touch it. Biden didn't touch it. It all had to be done by the president. This time around, you hear the media saying, everybody's saying, even Hegseth is saying, he ordered these strikes. That tells me that he got the power he was seeking in February to conduct drone strikes. And when you consider the amount of power that the U.S. military has at the border, and they designated so-and-so cartels as terrorists, before you know it, and in February I said we were a long way from drone strikes against immigrants at the border. We're not so far away from that now. We are not far away from that now. They say that they knew for a fact that these people on these boats were members of a cartel. So why not take them out of the water? Why not pick them up? Why not throw them in a prison? And why not negotiate with them to get more information? You're blowing these people up. You have no evidence that there's drugs because you destroyed everything. It reeks of outright criminality. These are war crimes happening right here in our front yard in the Caribbean. And it's just astounding to me that they think they can get away with it like that.
And even if we were to take it away from the context of war, it's just plain old murder.
Right.
Plain and simple, you know, recorded on video as well. So Egberto, I want to get your thoughts on what we've seen with these airstrikes. And again, what we see clearly with our own naked eyes, the idea that whether it be one boat or a dozen boats of these same size, of these same capacities, who has the idea that those little boats can push tons upon tons of drugs as it's being claimed by the Trump administration. It's just ridiculous.
On the face of it, you can actually see that it's a complete lie what they're doing. And the other thing is, why the hell would you need the largest aircraft carrier in the Caribbean to interject drugs? But, you know, I wish the media would take this to the other level, supply versus demand. I mean, come on, we're a capitalist country. Whenever there's a demand, somebody's going to provide the supply. If you want to go ahead and solve the drug problems, instead of spending billions on aircraft carriers and all these things, why is nobody in the media bringing up, why don't we stop the drug problem by making sure people are not in pain, who are on drugs, who need the drugs that are coming in? Why are we just bombing stuff as China is building South America, Central America, the Caribbean? I mean, nobody that I find in the media are taking one level of indirection to say, wait a minute, let's get people to start critically thinking so that they won't believe what Hegseth is saying about maximal lethality is why we're doing this and we want to stop all these drugs from coming over here. That is not the issue. And, you know, I'm glad that Arturo said, we understand what the issue is, but let's take it to the other level and make the American people understand that the issue isn't about blowing up these boats. It's a lot deeper than that. I want to digress a little bit because of something that I said before, and I want to kind of give it some context to answer your question. And that is, when I said, why aren't we solving the problem at home so we don't have to bomb, etc., I needed to give that context with what both you and Arturo said. And that is, the reality is that the military is down there not to solve any drug problem at all. Their ulterior motives, as you said, the oil. So therefore, why would they worry about, you know, solving the problem here or doing some other method? It doesn't make any sense if it's really for the oil, right? Now, that brings us into Juan. When Juan was pardoned, you had to ask yourself, if you're trying to interject in Venezuela, why soon thereafter would you pardon Juan Hernandez? Why? Why would you do that given the optics? And then at that point, you have to just start to think about, as we are upset about this, the whole infrastructure from our media to our population is sick. Because think about one pardoning a drug dealer moving tons of drugs, and that we don't have a revolt in how people are reporting it or people are seeing it or perceiving it, that you don't have a revolt from the media that says, wait a minute, what's going on here? I sit down sometimes and think I'm on some sort of a fatal comedy show because I can't believe, and sorry for not giving a very coherent answer, but I simply can't believe that this is happening, that this is reality.
You've been listening to part 3 of the Latino Media Collective 2025 Year in Review here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. Wishing everyone a safe holiday as we prepare to continue the struggle in 2026. Stay safe, everyone.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, January 9th. Here are some headlines. In Minneapolis today, outrage continues to grow after Minnesota's investigations agency said yesterday that the U.S. Attorney's Office is preventing them from taking part in the investigation into the killing by an ICE officer of Renee Good, a 37-year-old mother of three, thereby leaving the investigation up to the FBI. Numerous videos show that at the time of her death, Renee Good posed no threat to any ICE officer, despite the fact that numerous Trump officials are claiming exactly the opposite and accuse Renee Good of weaponizing her vehicle. In a press conference this morning, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey demanded the federal government allow state authorities to take part in the investigation, as he accused the Trump administration of already deciding what happened.
We in Minneapolis want a fair investigation. Is it deeply concerning that this administration from the very get-go is drawing the conclusion that they may ultimately come to? Of course it is. And if you got nothing to hide from, then don't hide from it.
Meanwhile, 1,500 miles away in Portland, Oregon, protests broke out last night over another shooting involving federal immigration agents.
Abolish ICE! Abolish ICE!
A man and a woman were shot yesterday afternoon by Border Patrol agents during a traffic stop near a hospital. Their medical conditions have not been released as of this morning. The Department of Homeland Security said in a statement that the pair are affiliated with the Tren de Aragua gang in Venezuela. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson condemned the shooting and demanded Immigration and Customs Enforcement to halt all operations in the city of Portland. Quote, "We cannot sit by while constitutional protections erode and bloodshed mounts. Portland is not a training ground for militarized agents and the full force threatened, and the full force threatened by the administration has deadly consequences." Close quote. Six protesters were arrested last night and charged with disorderly conduct. Officials in Oregon have launched an investigation into the shootings. In other news, today a jobs report for the month of December showed distressingly few new jobs added to the economy. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
New government data Friday showed the U.S. labor market ended 2025 on a weak note, with employers adding just 50,000 jobs in December, the lowest level of monthly hires since the pandemic. In fact, with December's jobs report, 2025 is officially the worst year for hires since 2020. The unemployment rate did fall slightly to 4.4%, down from 4.5% in November. This drop, analysts say, partly reflects fewer people actively looking for work, rather than a surge in hiring. Revisions to earlier months paints an even worse picture. October and November employment gains were revised down to a combined 76,000 jobs, showing how new job creation slacked for all of 2025. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
This is Branford Marcellus, and when I'm in the D.C. area, I listen to WPFW.